Welcome to Then and Now, brought to you by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy. We are dedicated to studying change in order to make change, linking knowledge of the past to the quest for a better future. Every week, we interview thought leaders, historians, researchers, and policymakers about what happened then and what that means for us now.
Welcome to Then and Now, a podcast sponsored by the Luskin Center for History and Policy at UCLA. My name is David Myers. I teach in the UCLA Department of History and direct the Luskin Center. Our goal at the center is to bring the past into conversation with the present, and in doing so, to understand how we got where we are so that we can imagine alternative and better futures. Our guest today is David Cole, who is one of the country's leading constitutional lawyers. David is the National Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, as well as the Honorable George J. Mitchell Professor in Law and Public Policy at the Georgetown University Law School. He's also the author of a number of important books, including No Equal Justice and Engines of Liberty, as well as almost monthly essays in the New York Review of Books. Welcome to the podcast, David.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Great. So several weeks ago, the United States Supreme Court issued a stunning 6-3 ruling prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQ people, quote, on the basis of sex, unquote. You know that well because you argued in the court on behalf of one of the plaintiffs, Amy Stevens. Now, in that surprising decision, the court grounded its logic in a reading of Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. Can you tell us what Title VII was? And wasn't the Civil Rights Act directed against race-based discrimination?
So it was principally directed against race-based discrimination. It came out of the civil rights movement of the 60s. It was passed in 64, but in the Senate, an effort was made by a Southern senator to try to kill the bill by adding a prohibition on sex discrimination, from his view, that was so ridiculous that you would have a law prohibiting sex discrimination, that this would kill the bill. But the momentum in favor of civil rights legislation was so strong that it didn't kill the bill, and the bill was enacted prohibiting employers across the country from discriminating against their employees based on race, national origin, and sex.
That's such an interesting history to it. I noticed, by the way, when I looked at it last night, that Title VI did not include sex. It was just Title VII that included sex in that list of other things to be protected. Is that right?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And Title VI to this day, which governs discrimination in entities that receive any federal funding, prohibits race discrimination, but not sex discrimination. So yeah, and I think this was a kind of an anomaly at the time. I mean, you have to remember this was before Ruth Bader Ginsburg, convinced the Supreme Court to recognize that sex discrimination violated the Equal Protection Clause. In the 60s, denying women jobs because they were women was not only not a violation of federal statutory law, but it wasn't a violation of the Equal Protection Clause, even if the government did it. And it was really before, feminism in its full power came onto the scene. So it was an early adoption of this notion that you can't discriminate on the basis of sex.
And would you trace the origins of the idea of sex discrimination as we know it to this, as it were, accidental inclusion or deliberate inclusion not for the purposes that we may intend it today? Is this the origin point of sex discrimination?
No.
You understand it?
I don't think so. It probably is the first federal law that prohibits sex discrimination. But, as we just, talked about, it was put in to try to kill a bill by someone who was opposed to the very idea of both, prohibiting race and sex discrimination. I think sex discrimination as a concept, the notion that, treating people differently because they are women or men, is that stemmed from feminism and from women's rights movement, and eventually got recognized in a, in local statutes, in some state laws, and then ultimately in the Constitution through through the litigation efforts of Ruth Bader Ginsburg when she was the head of the Women's Rights Project at the ACLU.
Mm-hmm. So just give us a sense of historical framing. What have been the peaks and valleys of law and sex discrimination since 64? 70 is a period of new feminist activism and expression. Does this give a significant push forward? Is it just beginning to germinate? What does the trajectory look like such that we can understand the decision of a couple of weeks ago?
Yeah, so, well, you know, I think it really was sort of the 70s and the 80s were the period, you know, following the civil rights movement. You had the women's rights movement and feminism, and it really, you then had a host of organizations created like the Women's Rights Project or the ACLU or the NOW, National Organization for Women, NOW Legal Defense Fund, that is a number of abortion rights groups were created, National Abortion Rights Action League, and they engaged in strategic litigation while, you know, their sisters engaged in lobbying in state legislatures, and ultimately the concept, I would say, by the sort of early 80s, the concept that it is inherently suspect to treat someone differently because they are a woman or because they are a man was widely accepted in state law, in federal law, and in constitutional law. Now, you know, there obviously are still, we're still fighting about it. We still have a Women's Rights Project, the ACLU. There are still you know, distinctions in how men and women are treated in with respect to dress codes, with respect to your ability to serve in certain parts of the military. But in some sense, formal equality for women was attained in that, you know, 1970s, 80s period. And now we are in the sort of post-formal equality period where it's really making those rights meaningful by, you know, bringing lawsuits, by expanding the concept of sex discrimination, by recognizing that discrimination on the basis of pregnancy, for example, is sex discrimination, by looking at structural causes of the fact that women still earn something like 70 some cents to every dollar that men earn and the like. So it's, you know, the battle continues, but the fight for formal recognition that sex discrimination was a problem, I think, was widely won in the 70s and 80s.
And in that regard, as you sort of retrace the steps of the history of sex discrimination, does that path conform to your theory in your book, Engines of Liberty, when you make a convincing argument that when it comes to carving out new rights, the most effective path to doing so is through bottom-up grassroots political organizing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think it's a coincidence that it was at the height of sort of that feminism that we saw, you know, both state and federal laws change, and the way that the Supreme Court interpreted the Constitution change. You know, people had been making those arguments for years, and they'd been rejected, and now suddenly they were accepted. And I think it was, you know, in large part because the women, you know, acting together and speaking out and objecting to their treatment changed the way society thought about. I mean, I think for a long time it was just sort of accepted. I mean, there were Supreme Court cases upholding laws prohibiting women from serving on juries because, you know, they were too, you know, fragile to serve on juries, or laws prohibiting women from even entering the legal profession, upheld by the Supreme Court on the ground that women are, you know, are the fairer sex and in need of protection. And, you know, it was women saying, no, you know, we want equality. We don't want protection. We want to be treated equally. And doing it collectively and through, you know, in all kinds of venues that I think made it possible for the law to reflect that change.
So I guess to the uninitiated, the question is, how should we understand the Supreme Court's decision? Should we understand the Supreme Court as driving change, or in this case as catching up to societal norms that had been shifting over the course of decades? Because it seems to us to be such a striking decision, especially given the composition of the Supreme Court at present.
Yeah. So I think it's reflecting change. It's in this case, it might be accelerating change, but it's mostly reflecting change. So to unpack that a little bit, I mean, the argument that we prevailed upon in the Supreme Court was that when you discriminate against someone for being gay or for being transgender, you are necessarily discriminating against them on the basis of sex. And the easiest way to see this is an employer who fires a man because he is gay. He is objecting to that man because that man is attracted to men. If he had a female employee who was attracted to men, he would not fire her. And so he is treating this male employee differently from a female employee for the same conduct of being attracted to men. That's a form of sex discrimination in the sort of most simplest sense. It is treating two people differently because of their sex. And the same thing for transgender equality. My client, Amy Stevens, was a transgender woman, and she notified her employer of a funeral home that she was going to come in and, she came out as a transgender woman, and she was going to come in and dress as a woman, and her name would be Amy Stevens, and she would follow the dress code for women. And he said, no thanks. You're not coming back to work. Why? Because I think you are a man. Because she was assigned a male sex at birth, he objected to her identifying and appearing as a woman. If she had been assigned a female sex at birth, he would have no objection to her identifying and dressing appearing, living openly as a woman. So he was treating her differently because of his view of her sex. And so that was the argument, right? And that's an argument. We didn't make up that argument. I mean, I certainly didn't make up that argument. That argument had been made on behalf of gay people for a very long time, starting in the 1970s. And it had been rejected time and time again. So that in the federal courts of appeals, there are about 12 federal courts of appeals or circuits around the country, and 10 of them had rejected the notion that when you fire someone for being gay, that is inherently sex discrimination. And in the last couple years, two circuits reversed that view. They went en banc, meaning that the whole court got together, and they reversed their earlier decisions. And they said, no, actually, discriminating against someone for being gay is a form of sex discrimination. But still, the courts were 10-2 against us when we went into the Supreme Court. It wasn't that the argument changed. I think it was that the world changed, and that the notion that that discriminating against people because they are gay is somehow rational or acceptable became unacceptable because gay people and transgender people came out, were open about who they were. Formed organizations to advocate for their equal dignity, and made it possible for us to prevail on an argument that had lost time and time again before. So I would say that's part of the story. The other part of the story, going to your question, is but this is a conservative court. Well, the argument we made to the court was one that was very consciously designed to appeal to conservatives, because the only way you win in the Supreme Court is if you appeal to at least one conservative, because there are 5 conservatives and 4 liberals on the court. So you've got to make arguments that are going to appeal to conservatives. And the argument was a textualist argument. And textualism is a conservative doctrine of statutory interpretation, which says the role of the court in interpreting a statute is to give meaning to the words in the text, not to try to figure out what Congress intended, not to ask what Congress, you know, thought it was doing at the time. And if you ask what Congress intended in 1964 or what it thought it was doing at the time in 1964, it was not intending to protect gay people or transgender people. But it wrote a law that prohibited discrimination, any discrimination because of sex. And the textualist on the court, Gorsuch is the sort of strongest textualist on the court, writes the opinion saying, you know, it doesn't matter that Congress didn't contemplate, it doesn't matter that Congress didn't intend it. We're guided by, and not only guided, but controlled by the terms on the page that Congress passed. They said, if you treat people differently because of sex, that's prohibited. When you fire someone for being gay, you are necessarily treating them differently than a woman who is also who is attracted to men, and that's discrimination because of sex. So we made a textualist conservative argument, but we were buoyed by this political movement of LGBT rights to make the argument, you know, acceptable.
Right. So that's really helpful. But can you help me understand how that principle, and as it evolved over time, took hold in the Supreme Court, sits with what seems to be the Supreme Court's decision to uphold the right of a baker in Colorado to refuse to make a wedding cake on religious grounds for a gay wedding? Because that would seem to be discrimination on the basis of sex, and yet it's permitted. So why is that permitted?
So
other forms of discrimination.
Yeah. So good question. That was also our case, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case. I represented the gay couple who was denied a wedding cake by the Masterpiece Cake Shop on religious grounds, as you suggested. Argument in that case that the baker made and that the United States, the Trump administration, made was exactly the argument you just articulated, which is that if you are, you know, refusing to serve somebody because you object to the message it sends on religious grounds, you don't have to serve them, even if state law says that you have to serve people regardless of their of their sexual orientation. The court did not accept that argument. The court took the case, and people thought they might accept that argument, but the court ultimately decided the case on a much narrower ground. It decided that the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that had adjudicated the baker's the complaint against the baker was itself anti-religious, because the one of the commission members made some comments that were viewed as very condemning of religion. And basically the court said, we're not deciding whether the baker has a right to discriminate against a gay couple because of his religious views. We're not deciding that. Well, all we're deciding is the baker has a right to have his case adjudicated by a forum that is not itself infected by religious discrimination. And so, you know, we lost that case, but we lost it in a very narrow way that does not establish a kind of First Amendment right to discriminate. And the court actually went out of its way to say in the opinion, religious or philosophical objections do not generally permit businesses to violate non-discrimination laws. And that's not a holding, because the ruling in the case was that in this case, the commission discriminated, but it did not establish the right to discriminate. That's still, you know, that issue still has to be litigated. And actually, at the end of the decision, Justice Gorsuch's in the Title VII cases 2 weeks ago, he says, he has a last paragraph that says, not presented in this case is whether and how the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a federal law that requires accommodate as a burden on religious exercise, we're not deciding whether the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in some circumstances might trump Title VII because it's not presented in the case, and so we're not deciding it. It's possible that it could for another day. That is the fight of the future, sort of the extent to which religious freedom, which is something this conservatives on this court in particular believe in very strongly, will create some kind of First Amendment right to discriminate. But they haven't yet gone that far. And the last thing I'd say is that, you know, those arguments were made in the 1960s and 70s to try to oppose anti-segregation laws. People said my religion compels segregation, and therefore I should not have to run an integrated restaurant. And the Supreme Court rejected them out of hand. So I think in the end, it will reject those arguments with respect to LGBT discrimination as well, but we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah. Meanwhile, we have seen this expanded purchase for the notion of religious liberty in ways that would seem to butt up against the protections against sexual sex discrimination. It remains to be seen in, I guess.
Right, without question, without
question. Yeah. So you are a veteran observer of and litigant in the Supreme Court. And on the basis of that, perhaps you can tell us what's going on in the Supreme Court these days. Since the appointment of Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, it would seem that there was an unbreakable conservative majority. And yet, over the past few weeks, we've seen a string of decidedly unconservative outcomes in the case you argued, together with Pamela Karlan, in the DACA case, in the recently announced abortion case. And I guess there are different grounds on each. In your case, it was textualism. In the abortion case with Chief Justice Roberts, it was precedent. But what's going on here? Can you help us understand why the Supreme Court is not acting like it would seem to be supposed to be acting?
Yeah. So I would say three things about that. The first is that in each of these critical cases, and, you know, to some degree surprising cases, Title VII, DACA, and the abortion case, the arguments made were conservative arguments. So we've already talked about how ours is conservative. The argument that prevailed in the abortion case was an appeal to stare decisis, to sticking to precedent. That's an inherently conservative notion, right? And then in the DACA case, it was the court concluded that the Trump administration had acted arbitrarily and capriciously in the reasons it gave for seeking to revoke the DACA protections that the 700,000 young undocumented immigrants were given by President Obama. The notion was that the government has to give some reason, some rational reason for its action. That also is a conservative argument. So, you know, in each case, a conservative argument won the day, and that's how you got a conservative, most usually Justice Roberts, but in our case, both Roberts and Gorsuch to join liberal results. The second thing I'd say is that in all three cases, there's been tremendous political organizing and pressure, right? We've already talked about the LGBT movement on DACA. I mean, the amount of public protest about, you know, about the Dreamers has really turned them into a very, very sympathetic group. And so even the vast majority of Republicans think that Dreamers should stay, should not be deported. And I think that has an effect. It's not a direct effect, but I think it has an effect. And on abortion, you know, there's been concerted political activity on both sides, right? On the side to overturn Roe versus Wade, but also and very much on the side to uphold Roe versus Wade. So you have conservative arguments, you have, you know, liberal movements that that exert some pressure, I think, on how the court decides these cases. And then I do think you have this sort of sense that the court, to be legitimate, has to rise above partisan politics. If these issues had gone to a legislature that was made up of five Republicans and four Democrats, no one doubts how they'd all come out. They would have all come out 5-4 with the Republicans lining up on one side and the Democrats lining up on the other side. And no one would have been surprised. And that's just how, you know, the legislature works. But that's not how a court should work. We appoint judges for life. They never have to run for re-election. And the sort of the quid pro quo there is they're not supposed to be partisan. They're supposed to decide things based on law, based on, you know, commitment to precedent, putting aside their political judgments to as much of a degree as they can. And that's an ideal, and it's a much kind of criticized ideal, and people think, you know, judges often fail to live up to it. But it's a very powerful ideal, and I think the court understands that it is central to their legitimacy. And so I think that operates also in the back of the minds of some of the justices, and especially Chief Justice Roberts, that, you know, we can't have every controversial case come out 5-4 Republican Democrat, or we will just, you know, lose our legitimacy as an institution. And I don't think he thinks, okay, I'm just going to give one to the Democrats in this instance. But I do think it operates at a kind of, you know, at the margins to say, let me be open. Let me keep an open mind on these cases. It sends the message that, you know, as he has said, we are not Trump judges and Obama judges and Clinton judges. We are judges.
Yeah. And it turns out that he is the decider because he apparently has voted with the majority 98% of the time and is himself not just the self-anointed and also officially anointed guardian of the institutional reputation of the Supreme Court, but he's very often the swing vote. So he can actually shape this agenda and shape this public image of the court. And from what other legal observers know, he very much accepts that role. Is that your sense?
Totally. Yeah, totally. But, you know, it's interesting that when Kennedy was on the court playing that role, Roberts felt much less need to do so. And there were a couple cases, you know, the most significant one being Obamacare, where he, you know, he did play that role, but way more often Kennedy played that role. And then when Kennedy left, you know, and Kavanaugh came onto the court, who's going to play that? You know, is anybody going to play that role? And I think, you know, I think there's sort of this kind of institutional pressure for somebody to play that role. Roberts has, I think, stepped into the breach. Now, I don't think he's going to be as likely to side with liberals on cases as Justice Kennedy was, but he's more likely to do that now, I think, than he was when Kennedy was on the court.
Yeah. So you've argued before the Supreme Court on many occasions. And I'm wondering if you could just share with us what it's like, and really at the end of the day, whether you believe that A, oral arguments matter, and B, whether you, as the National Legal Director of the ACLU, can get a fair hearing?
Well, we won this last case, so there we go. It's an incredible experience to argue before the court. I mean, I think oral advocacy, appellate advocacy, is just a it's my favorite thing to do in all the things I do as a professional. It's because you come into a forum, you've got judges who are very well prepared, with very smart people working for them. They're very smart, you know, thinking through all the hard questions in the case. You've got somebody on the other side who's going to be pushing back, you know, on you, and you have to meet. You can't finesse your way out of a hard question. You got to answer the question. So it's a tremendously exciting kind of intellectual challenge, I think. And this court there are a lot of very, very smart people on this court. And so you can get, you know, really great questions from any of them. I think it's I love doing it. Whether it makes a difference, you know, it's funny because you spend massive amounts of time preparing for argument. I mean, you spend more time writing the briefs, and people think the briefs are ultimately more likely to be dispositive because that's where the justices form their views. But you can finesse your way around difficult questions when you're writing, much harder when you're, you know, confronting a judge who says, answer the question, yes or no, you know. And so you spend a tremendous amount of time preparing. And then, you know, who's to say whether it makes a difference? It's very hard to know. People say you can definitely lose a case at oral argument, harder to win a case at oral argument. That is, if you do a really bad job or you really don't have good answers to the hard questions, it can reveal the weaknesses in your case. Whether you can win a case at oral argument, I don't know. You know, I don't think anybody really knows. But I do think, you know, that judges come into arguments pretty, you know, often knowing sort of where they're leaning, but wrecking every case the court takes, virtually every case the court takes is a hard case. They wouldn't get up there if it wasn't a hard case. There's good arguments on both sides. And so the ability of an advocate to answer questions in a way that gives comfort to a judge who might think you're on the right side, but he's not sure, I think can play an important role.
For example, like feeding them lines about textualism or stare decisis.
So, exactly.
Right. So, exactly. David, having secured this really stunning triumph in the case of LGBTQ rights, what is the next horizon in fighting for the rights of the discriminated or underrepresented? What bottom up efforts are underway to take a note of, like those that you identified in Engines of Liberty?
Yeah. So, you know, there's still, so first, I mean, the nice thing about this decision is because it says that discriminating against someone because they are gay or transgender is inherently sex discrimination, it basically and even though it was only in the context of Title VII, one federal statute involving employment, it basically turns every sex discrimination statute in the country, both federal sex discrimination statutes and state sex discrimination statutes, into LGBT discrimination statutes. Because by definition, when you discriminate against someone for being LGBTQ, you are discriminating against them because they're sex. And so it has a really broad impact in terms of achieving formal equality for LGBT folks. We still don't have constitutional protection. This is statutory protection. You know, it is conceivable that a legislature that was anti-gay or anti-trans could enact its own statute that says, you know, we are expressly excluding discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation or LGBT or transgender status, and that would trump this reading. So, you know, getting constitutional recognition of the impermissibility of discriminating against LGBTQ people is still on the horizon. But in addition, you know, you still have the battle that you know, African Americans are facing long after the courts recognized that race discrimination was impermissible, and that women continue to face long after the courts recognized that discrimination on the basis of sex is impermissible, which is the challenge of achieving lived equality, making these rights on paper meaningful, which is a much more difficult and complicated challenge. And then I do think, in particular, we have in the LGBT space the issue you identified earlier, which is how does religious freedom interplay with LGBT equality, and as Justice Gorsuch signaled, you know, we don't have an answer to that yet from the court.
Right. So maybe by way of conclusion, I want to just pick up on one of the things you just said, which is very much relevant to our current moment, and ask what role law, legal advocates, the ACLU, have to play in this current moment and movement of protest against racial inequality. What role can progressive legal advocates play in advancing the ball and pushing us beyond this deep structure of racism in American society?
Well, I think, you know, these protests have, you know, really put the spotlight on the criminal justice system as an engine of inequality in this country. And that's where, you know, the momentum is right now. That's where the focus is for reforming our criminal justice system. And you know, and I have long believed that. My first book was called No Equal Justice, Race and Class in the American Criminal Justice System. And, you know, you see some of the starkest racial disparities in our criminal justice system. And you see, you know, we have seen in our criminal justice system a willingness on the part of the larger community to invest in the inner city in the form of police and prosecutors and prisons, much more so than a willingness to invest in the inner city in the form of education, jobs, job training, aftercare, and all the other sorts of affirmative investments that would lift people up. Instead, we police them down. And I think, you know, that there's tremendous room for reforming and rethinking how we deal with inner city communities. And it includes restructuring police departments. It includes reducing the presence of police and in schools and providing social service responses to people as opposed to police responses as the first response, particularly with nonviolent kinds of infractions and the like. But it also includes reducing the criminal sentences that we that legislatures have authorized. We have the longest sentences by far in the, you know, in the Western world for the same kinds of offenses. There's no justification for the harshness of our sentences. It includes reforming prosecutors. Prosecutors have play a tremendous role in, have tremendous discretion in how people are charged, whether people are prosecuted, how long they go, they're sent away for by virtue of the charging decisions they make. If you have prosecutors that are committed to reform, you can do a lot to reduce incarceration, reduce police presence, and the like. And so, you know, there's been a movement in many places across the country to elect progressive prosecutors. And you've seen it in San Francisco, in Dallas, in Philadelphia, and many other places where progressive prosecutors have won elections and have really changed the way the criminal justice system responds to poverty in the inner city. And that's what it really is. It's about poverty in the inner city. So the ACLU is, we support those efforts. We have a smart justice program that's been around for a decade that is committed to reducing mass incarceration and reducing racial disparities in the criminal justice system. And we're, you know, all in on supporting police reform as well.
Well, thank you very much for a really illuminating conversation, David Cole. We're delighted to have hosted you on Then and Now.
Thanks so much for having me, David.
Then and Now is a production of the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy with support from the UCLA History Department. We can be found wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to our executive producer, Maya Ferdman, and our guest today, David Cole, for joining us. Until next time, stay safe and have a nice day.
Thank you for joining us this week on Then and Now. Then and Now is brought to you by the UCLA Luskin Center for History and Policy, where we study change to make change. For more on our work, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at our handle, @LuskinHistory. Our show is produced by Maya Ferdman and David Myers, with original music by Daniel Reichman. Special thanks to the UCLA History Department for its support, and thanks to you for listening.